Yeah, so tonight is a presentation on using the ACT matrix. So the matrix is a, well, it's my go-to tool, I think. If I was one tool that I could pick from all of my learning in acceptance and commitment therapy, this would be it. So acceptance and commitment therapy for people who may not be aware. So I did an introductory lecture on this a while back for counselling tutors. So you can check that out if you've got your membership. If you haven't seen that, or you haven't had anything that's kind of you haven't had your own intro to ACT, then very, very briefly, ACT is one of the therapies that forms part of the cognitive behavioral therapy tradition. It's a more contemporary model, a contemporary development sort of in the last 20 years, and it's very behavioral in its focus. It's really about helping people to choose behaviors that work for them, and to have the kind of flexibility to choose a course of action that's helpful in terms of, you know, being the kind of person they want to be, pursuing the life you want to live, pursuing the values that are important to you. And it's, as I say, emphasis on the behavioural. It's not really concerned with challenging thoughts or changing thoughts in the way that some other CBTs are, but it's interested in helping people choose behaviour that's functional. So to that end, ACT draws on behavioural roots. So going back to things like Pavlov and Skinner in particular, in terms of developing its theory and practice. So what I want to do, it's a bit lofty, it looks like a lofty ambition now I look down this list for the time that we have available, but I want to help us think about, go back to really old school principles around behaviorism and the ideas about the way you can help people classify their behavior, to use that as the basis for introducing the key principles of the ACT matrix, to think about how the ACT matrix maps onto ACT's broader model of psychological flexibility, give you a step-by-step procedure for using the matrix in practice. Rather than talk about it, I'm going to invite you to kind of do it. So there'll be a bit of experiential learning kind of from the inside out. Please treat that as an invitation and not an expectation. So if you just don't want to do the experiential bits of the lecture, then that's fine. You can tune out for that. And as always, I would say, you know, you get out what you put in, don't you? And the best learning takes place when we step outside of our comfort zones. So there's that invitation. And the presentation and the slides and the accompanying materials that Rory will give you access to will give you some useful questions to help you use this tool in practice. What I'm going to invite you to do, we'll dive straight in with the experiential bits right here and now, is to draw this on a page. So two arrows horizontally going in different directions. Now, what this represents is the, as I say, very old behavioral distinction about what organisms do. So you can count yourself among the world of organisms, but this applies across the board to any kind of animal in the whole of the animal kingdom. Is we do one of two things most of the time. We either do behavior that helps us move towards the things we want. The old word for this was behavior under appetitive control. And the etymology there is coming from the word appetite. So we move towards the things that we want. So non-verbal organisms, this is really straightforward. If I put food down in my dog's bowl, the dog will move towards the bowl. Is in that moment his behavior is under appetitive control. He's moving towards what he wants, to explore an appetitive stimulus. Now, the other thing that organisms do is they move away from what they don't want. So you might think of this as being avoidance. And that's perfectly functional too. So if I pick up my guitar and start playing, generally my dog leaves the room. That's not because he wants to go outside. It's because he wants to avoid the sound of my guitar playing. It's you know, rude, right? But me and him and the guitar playing just don't really get on. So we either move towards what we want or we move away from what we don't want. And you don't even need an central nervous system to see this behavior in action. You can single cell organisms have been known to, if you track their path through water, they will move towards light and they will move away from toxins, things that are bad for them. So both moving towards what we want and moving away from what we don't want are perfectly functional behaviors, and you need a mix of both to stay alive. So here we go, just to summarize that. So we're moving towards what we want to approach or explore an appetitive stimulus, or we move away from what we don't want to, you know, to escape or avoid an aversive stimulus. So just to give you a personal example, I spent some of yesterday afternoon watching West Bromwich Albion on Sky Sports. Well, that was me moving towards what I want. I enjoy football. I've got a passion for that. And that was a bit of downtime for me, you know, pursuing a value of, you know, relaxation and entertainment. What else have I done this week? I have avoided doing some marking for the university. I love most aspects of my job. I don't love the marking. So I did a bunch of things like tidy my office, answer emails that I didn't really need to answer, in order to avoid the marking. I was purely doing it to get away from doing something that I really don't want to do. So I'm sure you can, you know, given a moment, you could think of examples from your own week where the same things apply. You're either doing stuff that brings you closer to the things you enjoy, or it takes you further away from the things you don't like. The interesting thing about this, or the slightly complicating things, because on the face of it, that just sounds easy, doesn't it? I can classify my behaviours as towards or away, but actually it's a little bit more complex. If we think about this, the complex bit really is that any behaviour could be both a towards move or an away move. So I could run through a forest because I have a value of health and fitness, and I enjoy, say, trail running. I'm running through a forest to express my value of fitness, or I could run through a forest because I'm being chased by a bear. Now, a casual observer is just going to see a guy running through the forest, and it's the same behavior. It's exactly the same behavior. But you can appreciate how it would feel completely different in those two scenarios. Running because I'm pursuing a value of fitness is very different from running for my life, escaping from a bear. So experientially, it's very different. You could apply this to any behavior that you can think of. So even something that seems on the face of it, you know, a real towards move, it's exploring an appetitive stimulus. And so making love, for example, you can do that because that's exactly what you are doing. You're doing something very rewarding with someone that you love very much. But, you know, people do that to avoid an argument or to avoid an abusive situation. So again, the same behavior, but does different functions. You could move to a new house as a kind of real, you know, step forward in your life, a real positive development, moving towards greater and better things. Or you could move to a new house because you've been evicted because you couldn't afford to pay the rent. You can appreciate that the same behavior of moving to a new house feels very different under those different circumstances. You could diet because you're looking forward to, you're getting beach ready, or you could diet because the GP has told you that if you don't lose weight, you're going to die. Again, same behavior, it's going to feel very different. So this distinction is probably one of the most central, most important things I always teach my clients to understand. It's not about what you're doing, it's why you're doing it. To understand why you do the things you do. And that's very helpful because it helps you to make functional choices in life. A couple of things just to remember. The first point I've already gone across there, form and function aren't the same thing. So something that looks the same doesn't function in the same way. So that running through the forest idea, you know, looks the same as a towards move and an away move, but the function of it is very different. Intention and function aren't the same thing. I might touch you on the shoulder because I intend to comfort you, But actually, the function of me doing that, it could be really aversive. You could be like, well, why is this guy touching me? You know, you might have a history of abuse, for example, and being touched by someone is highly aversive. So what you intend and what the actual function of what you do, they're not the same thing at all. Any behavior, as I said, can be either a towards move or an away move. And things that functionally look similar, things that are functionally similar can look very different. So a good example might be when a client displays avoidance in sessions. I don't know about you, but I've had all sorts of experiences of avoidant clients, and their avoidant behavior looks very different. So you might have one client who's very intellectual, one client who uses a lot of humor to deflect from discomfort, another client who doesn't turn up for sessions, another one who does turn up but isn't really very present, someone else who turns up, says they're going to do a bunch of work between sessions and then doesn't. So all of those things, they're all very different behaviors, but functionally they are the same in that they have the function of avoiding discomfort. So this is, on the face of it, a very simple idea, but as with most things in life, when you get under the bonnet, slightly more complex. So back to your drawing. The next thing you can do is to draw a vertical line. So just as you see on the page there, I don't know why this one's dotted. It doesn't have to be dotted, but just an intersecting vertical line to create sort of a four quadrants on the page. The distinction I want to make here is that anything below the line is a sort of a private event. It occurs inside of you. So this would be your thoughts, your physiological sensations, your emotions, your values, that kind of stuff. I won't know about any of that unless you tell it to me. It's a private event. And then anything above the line is an observable thing. So it's an observable behavior. If I had a CCTV or a documentary film crew following around, these are the things I could see. I couldn't see your anxiety, but I might see behaviors that are associated with it. You know, I can't see the thought you might be having about I'm a fraud or I'm worthless, for example, but I might be able to see behaviors that are associated with that thought. So anything private goes below the line, anything sort of observable goes above the line. So I'm going to run you through a list of questions. This is the experiential part. So to sort of illustrate using the ACT matrix, I'd like you to kind of do it rather than just me talk about it. I'm going to give you a personal example just to kind of illustrate things as well. So when I'm using this model with people, this is where I usually start. So thinking of a particular situation, so I'm going to invite you to just, as you fill this out, just to think of a particular situation that, you know, is perhaps a bit of a stuck issue for you or a difficult thing you're experiencing at the moment. And I'm just going to ask you that question, like, in the context of this thing, what is it that matters? So who and what is important to you? So I'm going to give you an example. So my example relates to my job at the university. So we have a new cohort of students just started this term, and the whole thing is online. And so they are learning to be therapists, learning to be CBT therapists, and their whole experience thus far has been online. I think we managed to have one lecture live before we went into tier three restrictions. And so, you know, what I like to think of as a course that's very experiential, very interactive, is just now a bunch of people sitting in their bedroom. So this is vexing me, this whole thing, and I'm finding myself quite stressed about it. So who or what's important? For me, I would say, well, the students are really important. The clients, they're really important. That's why we're training all these therapists. And education is important to me, and connection. So I've got sort of two sets of people, students, clients, and then I would put two values of mine, education and interpersonal human connection. So that's what I would write in that box. So let's give you a moment. In the context of your situation that you want to go through here, who or what's important to you? And just make a couple of notes in there. Usually the briefer the better. Don't overthink it. Just respond to that question in a way that, feels right to you. Just a side note here, if when we're talking about values, if this helps you think about what to write, you know, values are things that are freely chosen. They reflect your desires rather than demands. So something that you want to do rather than things that you ought to feel that you should do. They act as a stimulus for reinforcing action. So it's something that you can enact. So I can enact the value of education by teaching. Teaching's like the goal, though. The value of education is different. Value indicates a general direction in life rather than just a destination. I'm imagining many of you have values of helping other people. Training to be a counsellor is one way of enacting that value, but it's not the only way. Once you know that helping people is important, there's all sorts of different ways you can act on that. From holding a door open, helping someone cross the road, sending someone a supportive text message. There's all sorts of different destinations on that journey of helping people. Values are a very mindful process. I think that unlike goals, which are usually either ahead of you or behind you, a value isn't something you need to wait around for. It's always with you. You know, helping people is just in you, isn't it? You might have a plan or a goal to help a particular person later in the week, but you know, the value of helping is always present. And largely, they're independent of the context. You know, helping people always matters. Education always matters to me. Doesn't really matter where I am. I'm always keen to kind of help people learn things. I don't have to justify it. You don't have to justify your value of helping people. It's one of those sort of, well, just because things. There's no particular answers to why. It just is. But we might prioritise. So at certain points in our life, we might choose helping people over other things, or we choose other things over helping people because the context may influence it to some degree. Okay, so back to our diagram. This is fast becoming my catchphrase, I think it's probably the thing I might have put on my gravestone at some point, not too soon, I hope. And it's this little saying that in your pain you find your values, and in your values you find your pain. We hurt and care about the same things, usually in a highly correlated way. You know, the people that we care about the most are usually the people that drive us, you know, up the wall the most. And, you know, the people that it would hurt most if you lost them. I think it was Queen Victoria that said, I think, that grief is the price you pay for love. You know, the more you love someone, the more it's going to hurt when you lose them. So, values and pain all tied up together. So that's the sort of rationale for this next question, that thinking back in the context of whatever you wrote in that first box there, what is that uncomfortable stuff that shows up sometimes and pulls you away from the things that matter? So going back to my example, so I care about my students, I care about their clients, I care about education and connection. But what I'm noticing at the moment, because I care about those things, is that I'm getting lots of thoughts like this course is rubbish. It's so unfair that these students are in this cohort, in the, you know, the COVID cohort. Our course isn't good enough. The experience is poor for them. That they don't get a chance to interact. This reflects badly on me as a course lead. Maybe the work they do with clients isn't very good. I notice myself feeling anxious, stressed, guilty. That's the kind of stuff I'd put in this box. Uncomfortable thoughts and feelings and sensations that show up in the context of me caring about the students and their clients and education and connection. So have a think for yourself. What's the difficult stuff that shows up in the context of you caring about the things you put in that first box there? If it helps, there's a little mnemonic which I often use with clients to sort of cover all the bases. So times. Thoughts, images, memories, emotions, sensations. You don't have to tick them all. It's not like bingo, but there's a kind of little checklist of the kinds of unwanted sensations that you experience in the context of caring about the things in the first box. Just give you a moment there to write something down. This is one of the weird things about doing things over Zoom or in the internet, isn't it? That in a classroom, I would see you all scribbling away, and I get lots of reinforcing feedback that people are on task. I don't know now. To sit with the uncertainty. It's another example of my value of education showing up as a sort of bit of discomfort. They're like two sides of the same coin. You know, we hurt and care about the same things. So next box here. So we're moving from the internal stuff to the external, the observable. But there's a little sort of 1930s film camera there just to remind you. Oh, look at those people reinforcing me. Look, Ruth says I'm on task. Wendy says I'm writing away, loving this. Great, thank you. That's good. All good. A bit of reassurance. So, right. So the question here is, what when all of that difficult stuff is showing up inside of you, the times, the thoughts, images, memories, emotions, sensations. When all of that's kicking off, what would we actually see you doing? So again, if we go with that sort of CCTV documentary film crew analogy, what would we see you do when you're struggling with all of that? So just to illustrate you with my personal example, so when I'm thinking all of those things, like I'm stressing about the quality of the course, or I'm feeling anxious, what I've noticed that I do a lot of is I try and read all of my university briefing emails, so to get up to speed with the university's pandemic plans. I notice I read those kind of slightly obsessively. I watch the news a lot to keep up with the latest developments, what's happening with universities or what's happening with the Birmingham area where I live. I'm sort of I don't know, talk to my partner, stress about it. None of it's in a very helpful way, really. It's helpful in the sense that it sort of makes me feel better in the short term. But I think there's a cost to it, which I'll come back to in a minute. But so, you know, but I do this stuff because it sort of makes me feel better. If I'm sort of worrying about the quality of the course, so I've convinced myself that I'm informed, I know what's going on, I know what the university's plans are, and, you know, that sort of makes me feel better, reassures me in a short term. I'm not sure it gets me very far in the long run. But just have a think for yourself. So when all of that stuff, in that bottom left corner there, is going on, all of those difficult thoughts and sensations, what would we see you do in your behavior? What do your avoidance moves look like? So have a little moment to fill that in. And one thing I'd just invite you to notice before we progress to the last box there is, however good those things might be at sort of turning down the volume on the distressing stuff in the second box, I wonder how good they are at connecting you with what's in the first box. You know, when I think of myself and those examples, so there's me obsessively reading emails or watching Boris Johnson on the news, how much of that is really about education and connection? How much of that really serves my students and my clients? You know, I think it's good. It might be good at helping me deal with the discomfort, but how close does it bring to my values? And I have to say, not close at all. In fact, it's almost like the polar opposite. What's going on with me is just I'm stressing on my own, not connecting with anyone, not really contributing to anyone's education, not really doing anything in the service of my students or their clients. It's really just about me feeling better. And there's nothing intrinsically wrong about that. You know, why wouldn't I make myself feel better? It's just that there's a cost to it, isn't there? And the cost of making myself feel better in the short term has to be kind of weighed up against, you know, what direction I want to take my life in the long run. So people often, when we get to this point, I've noticed a couple of, Carl there, there's a kind of frowny face there. And Annette said, dreadful, I go on Facebook. I would invite you to be self-compassionate at this point. We're assessing the function of the away moves. You know, you do that for a very good reason. You go on Facebook for a good reason, which is because it helps you feel better in the short term, or at least it avoids the distress. It's a way of you turning down the volume on the bad stuff. You know, and away moves are a valid option. There's nothing intrinsically wrong with it. I think back to a couple of years ago, I had quite a bad time personally, and I was quite depressed, and I had that thing that I'd read about in books where I got up one morning and I couldn't get up. I had that kind of thing where nothing was moving, and there was absolutely no way I was going to be able to turn in for work. And so I had a week off. I took a week off sick for mental health reasons, which was quite a big thing for me to do. But it was absolutely the right thing to do. It was an away move. It was all about me turning down the distress and the discomfort, and I needed to do it. So there's nothing intrinsically wrong about that. But if I was still doing it 2 years later, I don't think my life would be very rewarding. So it's kind of about learning when to move towards, when to move away, and to choose well, I think is the point here. It's not like just give yourself a hard time for your away moves. You probably do those for a very good reason. It's just that I would invite you to kind of be kind about it, be kind about those decisions. Sometimes, whilst they're, you know, you might not think it's your proudest moment, you know, maybe it's what you need at the time. So, yeah, promote, as it says there, promote a bit of self-compassion to kind of counter the sort of people get a bit fused with ideas of having to blame themselves or being self-critical. And I invite you to kind of make room for a sort of non-judgmental approach to this. Box four then. So if you weren't being driven by the discomfort, and you weren't doing things that were all about avoiding the discomfort, if you were being driven by your values, if you were being driven by the things in that first box, what would we see you do then? How would that be different? Maybe we do see that on the good days. So going back to my example, I think on the better days, when I'm being driven by education connection, I'm reaching out to the students, you know, I'm finding out how they are. So, for example, one of the things I've agreed to do this week is put on an extra tutorial ahead of assignment. And that's about us connecting and perhaps helping them to allay some of their fears, reassure them, give them some more information about the assignment. It's a thing that's not in the timetable. It's an extra thing we're putting on. Like, that feels much more like a value-driven move that will help. Much more in keeping with sort of how I want to be. I don't have a real way of getting rid of the anxiety, I don't think. I'm just going to take my anxiety with me, you know, into that tutorial. And now I'm going to choose to behave in a way that's consistent with my values, rather than behave in a way that's all about just turning down my distress. Over to you. Give you a moment to think about what's in that box there. So if you were acting in a way that's really consistent with the things you wrote in that first box, what would that look like? Again, same CCTV camera idea. What would we see you doing? Elaine's asked, are the slides going to be on the Counselling Tutor website? I think that's a question for Rory. I'm certainly happy for you to have them. You can have them, distribute them as you wish. Yep, they'll be uploaded on Thursday. There you go. Just a little reminder here, so if you're using this with clients, anything above the line is all about observable behaviour. It's actions rather than intentions. So people can't write things like, I'd be more confident, because that's not really observable. Like, so the question would be like, so if you were being more confident, what would we see on the CCTV? So Elaine, hopefully this slide might help with your question about what to put in box four. This is what kind of actions or behaviours would we see you doing if you were being, rather than being driven by getting away from the distress, if you, you know, turning down the bad stuff, if you were being driven by turning up the good stuff, if you were acting in a way that was consistent with your values, so whatever you put in the first box there, what would that look like? So, you know, it's towards moves, going back to what I said right at the top of the presentation. That's what we want to see in that box. Things that are driven by you moving towards what you want, or, you know, the ACT term for that often we use is values, but it's things that are intrinsically reinforcing. So, one space there in the middle. So the question to pose to you about this middle box is like, who's the one person in the world that's got the helicopter view out of all this? So who's the one person in the world who knows really well what it is that matters to you, what's important, also knows what the difficult stuff is that shows up and, you know, gets in the way when you try and act on things that are important. And the one person in the world who knows the choices that you have, that you can either sort of do things that are about reducing your distress, or you can do things that are about moving towards the kind of life that you want. I wonder who that person is. It's me, or it's you. You know, I'm the only person really that's got the helicopter view here, and so are you. In terms of your stuff, you're the only person that's got that overall view and can make those choices. And that's there. Got it. Myself, absolutely. And so ACT is about kind of helping people to tune in, to take a sort of cross section, look at this whole situation. What do I care about? How am I hurting? What are my behavioural choices, you know, in this moment? And what would be the thing that would help me most? You know, should I make a towards move in this moment, or should I make an away move? Should it be some kind of mixture of both? You know, how am I going to respond to this particular context that I find myself in? So that, you know, that me, that part of me that we're thinking about here is there's that part of you that's sort of in contact with the present, having a helicopter view. It's the sort of me it's distinct from the stuff I think or feel. It's like, you know, I'm the thinker, not the thought. It's that bit of me that's the noticer. So if I can notice this stuff, I can notice my stress and my anxiety, I can also choose how to respond to it. You know, maybe I can't choose whether to be stressed or anxious. That stuff just happens. But I can choose how to respond to that. I can choose to respond to it in a way that's all about just getting rid of that stress and anxiety, or I can, in a way that often sort of makes life a bit small, or I can choose to sort of, you know, notice and accept that I'm feeling stressed and anxious and take a value-driven choice anyway. So this is like, yeah, Jenny's got it there, like an observer perspective, the observing self, or sometimes in Buddhism, this is known as a kind of like transcendent sense of self. It's the difference between the sky and the weather, so to speak. You know, the sky is the place where the weather happens, and however bad the weather gets, the sky never gets damaged. The sky can always is like the container for the weather, just like, you know, I am the container for my thoughts and feelings. So we've got tuning into that part of us that can make those choices. So a few questions, I'm just going to rattle through these, but you know, you can answer these in your head as I ask them. So all those that away stuff, you know, has what you've done to get rid of the unwanted stuff worked? You know, has it worked? Does it go away? Has it helped you move towards what's important to you? You know, certainly the answer is no for me. That doesn't help me at all. Helps me feel a little better in the short term, doesn't help me move towards what's important to me in the long term. What towards moves have your away moves stopped you from doing? So, you know, what could you have been doing with your time instead of doing all that away stuff? Has it got in the way of you acting in more constructive ways? What would the person you would want to be do? You know, like you on a good day, that the best version of you, you know, how would that person act in this situation? And could you move with the times? So, you know, it's going back to this idea of those uncomfortable thoughts, images, memories, emotions, sensations. Could you have all of that and still make a towards move, you know, make a value driven move? You know, even when you're, you know, your body is saying, no, I can't, I'm too stressed or I'm too anxious. You know, is it possible to still go and do things that matter? And, you know, as I say, take your anxiety with you, move with the times. Here's a good question. If you think about all that stuff in blue there, like, what would you have to give up caring about in order to like never experience this suffering? You know, what would I have to give up caring about if I, in order to guarantee that I never had the thoughts like, is this course good enough? Am I doing the best for the students? Are they getting the best experience? Are they learning enough? Like, what would I have to give up caring about in order to never have that? You know. And the answer, of course, is I'd have to give up caring about education. I'd have to give up caring about them. You know, is that a choice I want to make? I often think that about education. You know, I thought that about tonight. You know, I could pitch up with, you know, I've probably got some 10-year-old PowerPoint somewhere. I'll just present that. I'll read off the slides. I won't put any effort into it. I won't give any of myself to it. I bet my anxiety about tonight would have disappeared. You know, as it happens, I was, yeah, quite anxious about tonight. Anxious about the fact it goes well. It's because I care about education. You know, if I just decided, oh, I don't care whether anyone learns anything or not. You know, Rory will probably just pay me anyway, never have to see him again. I could give up caring about any of that. I'm sure I'd have been much less anxious. The question is, is that who I want to be? Is that who I want to be? You know, and if the suffering, if it was merely the cost of the valuing, you know, could you just choose to pay the cost in order to pursue what you value? So, like, every time I do some teaching, I get anxious because education matters to me. Now, what I've come to understand, I think for me certainly, is that it's just like anxiety is the price tag of caring about education. So I am happy to have it, and you know what, I kind of think that if I go and do some teaching one day and I don't feel at all anxious, then that's probably the day to go and get another job, because I think that's the day I've given up caring about it. I think it, you know, it's yeah, absolutely. Yasmin says it's hard to switch that off, right? It's hard to switch that off. I think it's impossible to switch it off, to be honest. If you care about it will make you anxious or stressed, or it will be the thing that gives rise to guilt or low mood or whatever. And I just think that's part of the deal. Sometimes I'll ask clients, maybe I'll pose this question to you, you know, think of something that you are really proud of. You know, if you like, if you were going to die tomorrow, you could turn around and say, well, do you know what? At least I did that. I'm really proud of that. I bet you that whatever that thing is, it has been a difficult journey. It's been a difficult road, something that has given rise to lots of stress. You know, most people, when I ask them that question, they'll answer with things like, you know, bringing up my kids, learning to drive, getting my degree, my career, surviving childhood abuse, overcoming a difficult illness. The proudest moments in our lives are the things that hurt. You know, they were difficult. And I don't have a healthy way of separating that out. I just think that is how it is. And so it's really about, you know, is it worth it? You've got to figure the things out. What are the things that are worth suffering for? And that's really the only thing we've got to sort out. So there's the last question. What do you see as you look at it? You know, has this been helpful? Does it point you a way forward? Does it say to you that, you know, I need to be clearer on my values, or does it say to you I need to do a better job of caring for myself? Does it say that I've got some different choices I could make here? I can always choose. What I would like you to go away with is just no, sort of noticing that there's you in the middle. You can always see what's going on here, and those things that distress you, they are just the price tag of the things that you care about. And once you know that, you can figure out like what's the most helpful way forward. You know, maybe rather than seeing the discomfort as the automatic cue to go and do a bunch of avoidance, you can see it as the automatic cue to choose whether to do a bunch of avoidance or whether to take a valued, you know, step in your sort of towards step in your value direction. And that's it, really. It's just about helping you choose more wisely how to navigate this difficult thing called life. Okay. Conscious of the time, I said I was going to wrap up by 2:15. We're just about there. If you're interested in this, sort of how the ACT model maps on here, then, you know, the matrix is looking at things in this way. We started out thinking about values. We then moved on to thinking about all the difficult thoughts and feelings you get stuck with. Encouraged some acceptance of that one is the cost of the other. Looked at the various things you do to get rid of the discomfort and the actions that you could take that would take you towards your values. I'm not going to go through these, but these are a bunch of useful questions that are just on slides if you're trying to elicit you know, content for each one of those boxes. I won't go through that now, but as I say, that's for you to look at in your own time. And that's me done. And those are my contact details on my website, email address there, and then you can find me on Twitter. And one of the things I always think about ACT is that, you know, if it's like a value-driven thing. If you think something is useful, then tell other people about it. That's why I'm on Twitter. So this is a useful model that's really helped me in my professional life and personal life. So if it's helped you, then tell someone else about it.